Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we are going to be speaking about the Santa Fe Community College Media Arts Film Spring event. I'm very glad now to welcome back to the show Bill Dubuis. He's a writer and conservationist. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's always great to be here, Mary Charlotte.
And last time we talked to you, I think it was last October, and we were talking about this extremely endangered mammal called the sow la. And since we seem to be the world leader in doing radio broadcasts on this particular mammal, we thought we would get an update because you were recently in Laos.
That's right. And I've got to say thank you yet again. I feel as though your show is the sow la world broadcasting system. This is the first vehicle through which many Americans, frankly, have heard about sow la, both through the show directly and from your podcast postings, that actually the people involved in sow la conservation have been passing around the URLs to those podcasts, to funders and a lot of other people, to inform them about this extraordinary creature.
Well, it is an extraordinary creature, and for those who have not heard these broadcasts before and who don't know what the sow la is, tell us about this mammal, which was discovered by science. I mean, the people in Laos and Vietnam have known about it all along, but has been discovered by biologists and science only since the 1990s.
That's right. It was in 1992 that a biologist on a field survey in Vietnam on a Sunday, walking down from camp to a local village to buy some rice wine to have just a little bit of hooch to drink, saw an unusual trophy hanging on a hunter's wall and asked about this creature, realized when he saw the trophy that no one had ever described this animal in science. It was in no manuals, no field guides, no fauna for the region. And since then, a few sow la have actually been examined. None has lived long in captivity. If you were to see one on a sort of half-lit night in profile, you would swear it was a unicorn. It's close.
Except it's got two horns, but other than that.
But if the face is profiled, so the two horns merge into one, it is a horn just like a unicorn's horn.
It's long, pointed.
Very tapered, very sharp, really quite elegant, quite beautiful. The animal in general is just gorgeous. It has these bold white splashes of color on its muzzle, and it seems to have, like the unicorns of myth and legend, an extraordinarily serene disposition. In captivity, on those rare occasions for brief periods of time when there have been sow la in captivity to examine, they have shown an extremely serene and calm disposition. My friend Bill Robichaud, whom you know,
who's been on the show a couple of times talking about this animal.
That's right. And Bill was in the company of a sow la, which he named Martha back in 1995.
Right.
And he said Martha was calmer and easier to approach than any domestic cow or sheep or goat he'd ever been around.
And it was scared only of dogs. It wasn't scared of human beings or anything else.
That's right. Violently scared of dogs or angered by dogs. It became aggressive when a dog came around. And we think that's because the sow la evolved in a landscape, in a biome, where its principal predator was the dhole, the Asian wild dog. And so the sow la is hardwired to react very strongly to canine creatures of all kinds.
Now, to recap some of our other conversations, this creature is critically endangered. It's more endangered than many, many extremely endangered mammals. There's only maybe several hundred of them left. They live only on the border area of Laos and Vietnam. And poaching, not for sow la themselves, but these snares that the Vietnamese traders use to poach other animals. They trap the sow las, they die, and that's one of the major reasons that they're endangered.
That's what we believe, yes. And in terms of the sow las' prospects for survival, and we're talking about a large mammal here, something its nearest relatives are wild cattle. It might weigh 200 pounds, 190 pounds. The sow la is so rare, even the villagers in the region see them only very, very seldom, maybe once every couple of years per village. And we don't really know if, in terms of extinction of the sow la, it is 2 minutes until midnight or 2 minutes after.
Right. They might all be gone already.
Yes, or the population density may be down so low that there just aren't enough to come together to breed to produce another viable generation of animals.
Bill Dubois, you were recently there visiting Bill Robichaud, and you went into the forest to see what was going on.
That's right. We went into the largest protected area in either Vietnam or Laos. It's called Nakai Nam Thun National Protected Area, and it's about 4,000 square kilometers. It's a big place, runs right up to the Vietnamese border. It actually has management funds, which is a rare thing in the poorer countries of Asia. Management funds that are kicked off from a big hydro project downstream from the protected area. And so we went in. We traveled 2 days by boat with a little bit of hiking in between boats to cross some ground. And then from a village deep in the protected area, the protected area has about 6,000 villagers who live within it. From a village there called Ban Namoi, we then trekked in expedition into sow la habitat and were on the trail for about 8 days.
Now, were you officially in Laos or Vietnam?
We were in Laos the entire time. We didn't cross over to Vietnam, though we were very close to the border. And we actually made two expeditions, one into the Nam Yang country, the watershed of the Yang River, if you will. And then later, jumping off from a different village base, we made an expedition up the Nam Mon, Mulberry River, and went to a mineral lick high near the headquarters of the Nam Mon, where we set up a battery of six camera traps around the mineral lick where sow la have been known to come. And we're hoping that through the rainy season, which is just beginning in Laos, that those cameras might capture an image of a live sow la.
Camera traps are these devices that are kind of like motion detectors, and when an animal goes by, the camera takes a picture. I guess they're pretty weatherproof.
We hope they are. We hope they are.
And, of course, they don't just take pictures of sow la, they take pictures of anybody who goes by. Mm-hmm. So you get all kinds of wildlife on these pictures when you go to see what's there.
If you're in a good spot, and if the forest still has its population, and this is the big question, the level of poaching in much of this area is so intense that the forests are being emptied of their biota.
Now, I thought this was a quote unquote protected area.
Well, there's the big issue, and I think of this as the title of this topic is the politics of extinction, because here we have a big protected area that is ostensibly managed and its management is funded, and yet poachers come over the border from Vietnam with almost complete impunity and set up snare systems that are sometimes kilometers long, and a snare line might run for a kilometer. It's a low fence of brush piled up, brush and saplings and other forest detritus. And every 3 meters or so, there would be a gap. And in each gap, there is a snare, a wire loop made of bicycle brake cable with a trigger, so that if an animal steps into that, hits the trigger, then the sapling to which the snare is attached will spring back up and pull the animal into the air, and then it will dangle there and die a very, very
gruesome
death. Yes.
It'll just, it's like death by slow hanging.
But death by the slowest kind of hanging you can imagine.
Oh, Lord.
And so as we made our way through the jungle, we would encounter these snare lines, and the poachers leave them armed. They leave them triggered even when they go back to Vietnam. So these things are out there for months and months and months.
And so you find these decomposed animals.
Yes, ferret badgers, hog badgers, large antlered muntjac, jungle fowl, silver pheasant, mongoose. We even found, this was the particular heartbreak, we saw a Duke langur that had been taken by one of these snares and died. The Duke langur is perhaps the most beautiful primate on the planet. It's an absolutely gorgeous, multicolored, gray and red and white monkey. Just a spectacular animal. And we stood there and sort of imagined, you know, how this beast spent its last days and how its troop might have gathered around it and tried in a confused way to offer some kind of aid or assistance.
But the other monkeys couldn't get him out.
No, no.
So when you were there, what was your group like? Who was there with you besides Bill Robichaud, and did you take down snares?
Yes, we, in the course of the first expedition, we collected almost 800 snares, and we consisted of, Robichaud was the only other Westerner there, and he was the only person who spoke English, so I was in an interesting position as a non-Lao speaker of really being an observer, and it was good practice for me, good discipline to be incommunicado except for smiles and a few, a handful of badly pronounced Lao words. But there was a Robichaud, there were two university students with us, there was a dynamic young man by the name of Samuang representing the Water and Power Management Authority, which is the entity responsible for managing the natural area. And then there were, on the first expedition, nine guides / porters, local Sek villagers, three of whom were militia and who carried AK-47s.
To protect you.
Yes, to provide security for the expedition. We expected to encounter Vietnamese while we were there. And one morning at about 4 a.m., some of the guides, I was camped on the other side of the camp, but some of the guides saw a headlight coming down the trail for them, and so they rallied to the militia, grabbed their guns, and gave chase, but didn't catch whoever it was under the headlamp.
So there's poachers in the woods, and of course, as we've discussed before, the poachers are there trying to get animals for the Chinese population that believes that the bones and horns of certain animals cure diseases or give them virility or things like that.
That's correct. The trade fuels both traditional Chinese medicine and also, interestingly, the restaurant trade, the bushmeat. Side of the restaurant trade. And there's an interesting overlap between the belief in medicinal cures and in the attraction of wild meat. In the cultures of China and Vietnam, anything wild is regarded as healthier to eat than anything domestic. And so if you sit down to a nice meal of monkey, it may not be specifically a cure, but it is regarded as very, very healthful. And so the whole bushmeat business is partly driven by health concerns, as well as conspicuous consumption. These foods cost a lot more than domestically produced foods. But in the rising economies of the Asian tigers, China and Vietnam, more and more people can afford to pay steep prices for extravagant traditional cures and for show-off meals of wild foods in the restaurants in both nations.
Is there any, I don't know if you can speak to this, but is there any validity to these traditional cures?
I have no idea. I really don't. I mean, I'm a fairly extreme skeptic on these matters. I don't think that rhino horns help men preserve their virility, or that tiger bone makes one's spirit more powerful. I think most of this is just snake oil and foolishness. But it's snake oil and foolishness with long, long historical roots. Here in New Mexico, folks used to believe that carrying a scrap of osha root in your pocket would help guard you against a snake bite. You know, I don't quite think that was true, but osha does have some true utility in calming one's stomach and so forth. So there's a little bit of truth and there's a little bit of baloney in all these things.
We're talking to Bill Dubuis about the Sao La, the extraordinary, beautiful, mysterious, shy mammal found on the border of Laos and Vietnam. And of course, you didn't see a Sao La when you were there, neither from a camera nor in real life.
No, we didn't. And no Westerner has ever seen a Sao La in the wild.
Including the biologists who love them, study them, and so on.
Absolutely none. However, in some of the area where we were, Robichaud's blue eyes and my blue eyes were the first blue eyes to gaze on some of the country we were traveling through.
Very interesting.
So we were surveying habitat that no Westerner had ever been in before.
And as you say, this is habitat that is being systematically emptied of mammals,
basically
of
everything that moves, every protein on the move. And we're talking about snakes, turtles, a fair number of birds, and certainly any kind of mammal that might be there. We came across quite a few temporarily abandoned poacher camps. And so the equipment in the camps tells you a lot about what goes on. There would be a butchering table. There would be a smoking rack above a big fire. There would be, perhaps off to the side, a roasting pit. There would be tethers for live animals, and there would be a log crib for other live animals, particularly porcupines, which would be tied up and carried back live. They fetch more money delivered live to the restaurants.
What are the politics in Vietnam and Laos of dealing with poachers? I mean, you say they act with impunity. Is there not, I mean, are there laws? Are the laws followed in any way? Are there enforcement strategies? What's going on?
The laws are very clear that the poaching is illegal and that anyone caught doing it would be subject to fine, imprisonment, or both. What usually happens is that they're fined and then packed off back across the border. Maybe somebody's held as a hostage until the fine is paid.
And then the fine is paid, but they make lots of money poaching, so it's like a
joke. And they just come right back, yeah. I mean, the phrase that is used in U.S. border issues is that the U.S. needs to obtain operational control of the border. That's what the politicians in Washington throw back and forth. And in Laos, the Lao authorities have no operational control of their border along most of its length with Vietnam. There may be the occasional patrol, but sometimes the patrols don't really want to encounter the Vietnamese because then things get testier and more complicated and more dangerous. And so patrols go out, but they wander in areas where it's least likely that they would find the poachers, where no patrols go out at all. But at stake here is one of the most diverse, most extraordinary biological areas on the planet, a true biological biodiversity hotspot.
So tell us about the movement to actually change this situation politically, in terms of enforcement, and in terms of, I think very importantly, getting the Laotian people and perhaps Vietnamese people as well on board with environmental protection for the Sao La, but not only the Sao La.
Yes, I mean, if the protection is there for the Sao La, then many, many other species will benefit, an extraordinary number of species. And so the challenge is partly to convince the appropriate Lao officials of the true urgency of the situation, that they've got to put more resources into this, and that they've got to recruit leadership that really wants to make a difference. In terms of institutional history, the only real organizational experience that a lot of Lao people have is what they've learned by working in the Communist Party, and the party rewards people who don't make waves and who know how to advance by cronyism. And that's not the kind of school that will produce decisive leaders with initiative. And that's what's really called for here to get control of the border.
So what attempts are being made in that direction?
Well, just repeated attempts to convince the leadership that they need to act, and perhaps that they need to hire an NGO and contract out some of the enforcement. One of the forces that could come to bear here, if the high-ups realize what's really going on, is the World Bank and other international lenders whose conservation credibility, in a sense, is on the line with the hydropower project that I mentioned earlier, the Nam Thun 2 hydroelectric dam and reservoir, which cost $1.3 billion, funded by these international lenders. And the whole deal was presented as a trade-off. We're going to drown this plateau for a hydro reservoir, but we're going to use income from that project to absolutely save and preserve the biodiversity of the upper watershed. And that's the area where Robichaud and I were. Well, it's not working out that way.
Right.
And so all these promises that were made and all this money, all these agreements, all the multi-party contracts and so forth are in a way being devalidated by the uncontrolled poaching from across the border.
So lots of work to be done, and people like wildlife conservation biologist Bill Robichaud, devoting his entire life, has learned the Lao language.
Oh, he's so fluent. I mean, he can badger, cajole, entertain, argue, you name it. He can do it all in Lao.
And so a small number of people, Americans, Europeans, and so on, have devoted their lives to this. You talked about the bureaucratic problem, the leadership problem. What about on the level of villagers, of the common people?
Well, that's a very interesting question. The villagers in that area are in the throes of very rapid economic and technological change. I mean, they're just now getting motorbikes and hand tractors and metal roofs and other equipment. Their lives are improving a lot. Their income is rising rapidly. Some of that income is coming from the wildlife trade, and some of it's coming from the poaching of rosewood, another very important forest commodity that commands a high price, about $5,000 per cubic meter. And so,
non-renewable resources both.
Yes, in a way.
Unless it's done very, very carefully.
That's right, because the rosewood is just being stripped out of the forest. So the villagers are in an interesting position. They benefit from this, but at the same time, they see their heritage being squandered. And winning their true support for conservation is an ongoing challenge. But it's by no means one that can't be successful.
What did you actually see in regard to that?
Well, we had quite a few meetings with village leaders, and it was interesting to try to gauge their true intentions as opposed to simply what they said. But in general, they seem committed and interested in preserving the biodiversity of their area. At the same time, there's great temptation for people to profit from it. I mean, while we were there, we heard of a guy in a nearby village who had just found a golden turtle and sold it for the equivalent of about $4,000. That's a fortune
yeah.
in that economy.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking to Bill Dubuis. Now, one thing that recently happened is that there's a story about a rhino that was poached and killed in Vietnam that was actually a very important situation.
Yes, and it has some implications for Sao La conservation, especially in Vietnam. The Vietnamese had been very proud that they still had rhino in Vietnam. And in this one preserve, which was the last holdout for the species, various research was done, actually some work with dung dogs, dogs that are trained to identify rhino scat. And it's a way of censusing whether rhinos...
Dung dogs.
Dung dogs, yes. And at any rate, the results from that work are still being analyzed for DNA, but what appears to have happened is that they did find one individual of the species, but that individual turned out to have been shot in the foreleg, and complications from the wound eventually, some months later, led to the death of the animal. And so suddenly, at first, this was denied. It was said by the authorities that the animal died of natural causes, and maybe there were more rhinos and so forth, but in fact, it appears this is the last Javan rhino in Vietnam, and it was killed by poachers, and it was killed in an area that was supposed to have had strong security and intense patrols. Well, this was embarrassing to the authorities, and as a result, there seems to be some genuinely new determination to do better and to mount more patrols and with well-trained people. And also, Vietnam has set aside a specific area of Sao La habitat as a Sao La preserve. So these are all positive signs that come from the tragic death of that last rhino.
It's such an interesting, not in a good way, but such an interesting time we're living in the sense that we are seeing so many species on the brink, so many species already having gone extinct, and this movement on the part of people who care and see the big ecological picture versus people who are pretty much out for economic gain in whatever their area is, whether it be large corporations or small individual poachers, basically driving the extinction.
That's right. The image that comes to my mind is one of a... You've seen the cartoons or the children's drawings of lines of animals heading toward Noah's Ark to get on. Well, I see similar kinds of lines of animals just heading into the mists of extinction, one fabulous creature after another. And in my work on this project, I'm interviewing a lot of conservationists, and I always ask them, what gives you hope? What keeps you going? And often the answer is, who said I have hope? And usually the answer is something like, you know, this is what I do, this is what I'm trained to do, and I'm going to keep doing it until the last hope, the last opportunity, the last prayer is gone. These are very dedicated people, but an awful lot of them are burning out.
I think it's so important. We talked to Nathan Newcomer last week about Otero Mesa and all the creatures there and the threat of hard rock mining and mountaintop removal and so on. And we talked to Bill Robichaud last October, and people can hear the podcast if they look on santafe.radiocafe.org. And the reason that keeps people going is not necessarily the importance of ecosystems, although it's important. They are our life support system. We cannot survive in a 100% concrete world. We depend on the plants and animals and microorganisms around us to survive as a species. But more than that, there's just a simple moral and aesthetic argument. These things, these animals are beautiful. They deserve to live.
Exactly. We can talk about cures for cancer and all that kind of stuff, but when you come right down to it, there is an imperative just in the beauty that I think we need to be alert to and to pursue. And, you know, there's a fancy way about talking about this. I don't know if it was Augustine or Aquinas who emphasize the difference between instrumental good and intrinsic good. But instrumental good is, you pursue instrumental good to achieve a result. And if you don't achieve the result, saving a species, say, you're kind of up the creek. But intrinsic good is a different kind of thing where you pursue the good, you do the work just because it's right to do it. And I think that's the case battling these sort of late hours of extinction for some of these species.
So you are documenting this whole story. Are we going to see a book one of these days?
Well, I hope so. There's that passage in Moby Dick where Melville writes, "Oh, time, strength, cash, and patience." It just takes those things to produce a book. And so I'm working on that, and I'm already headed back to Vietnam on the 3rd of June. I'm going to go to Hanoi, spend pretty much all my time in Hanoi to interview people who were involved in the discovery of Sao La back in 1992 and people who are involved in monitoring and combating the wildlife trade today.
Bill DeBuys is a writer and conservationist. And if you want to find more about the Sao La, you can go to savethesaola.org. S-A-O-L-A is how you spell the name of that animal. Bill DeBuys, thanks so much for being with us. And we will request updates as they happen in the story of this animal.
Well, it's great to be back here with Sao La World Broadcasting again, Mary Charlotte. Thank you.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Monique Anair. She's co-chair of the Media Arts and Film Department at Santa Fe Community College, and Jean Medeiros, who's head of post-production at SFCC. And we're here to talk about a wonderful event. It's the Media Arts Film Spring Event. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi.
So you do what at first sounded to me a little bit not as exciting as all that, namely student work, which you're showing on May 22nd. But there's so much, it's this coming Sunday, there's so much great work coming up. There's a happening at the community college film program.
Yeah, we have over 350 students right now, and we have cinematography classes, editing classes, animation classes, all sorts of production from documentary to narrative to experimental audio installation. And so this is almost like a best of what we do at the school. Every semester is the students in their classes jury 10 minutes of work from each of their classes, and then they submit that to represent their class, and there's a jury of students, staff, and faculty that get together and kind of compile the show. And so there's a huge, just a variety of work to begin with, so it's a really stimulating show, and we really have kind of focused on, and Jean can talk to this too, because, you know, when we first started, people were submitting 90-minute pieces of student work, and I know when you're a student, you fall in love with your work, and you think it's like, oh, this is going to be so great, and everyone's right. going to love it, and everyone's falling asleep. So we really have gone to the short format, and we really have actually focused on 3-minute format.
Well, part of it was to get them to realize that there are other distribution models than making the feature-length film, which you would hope and pray would be picked up and distributed by someone else. 3 minutes to 3.5 minutes is the recommended maximum length for things on the web. And since most young people today...
Oh, because everyone's putting things on YouTube?
Yeah, they can put it on YouTube, they can put it on their own websites. Most young people today get their media off the web. They don't look at television sets at home with the parents anymore. They're on the computer. That's where they see their films. That's where they see their programs. That's where they, whatever passes for news in youth culture, the way they spread news around, it's all done through the computer nowadays. So that length, it's easy to upload. It meets the requirements for most sites. It doesn't take a lot of gigabytes to transfer from one device or one to the other. You can send it out and get a really large audience, but only if it's short. And, you know, they have to make it short, and they have to have a story arc in 3 minutes. And it's kind of like the craft of, you should write a lot of short stories before you attempt a novel, because the learning of writing is getting everything you need to say done in the short story. It's the same idea here. The short film is how you learn how to tell your story without extraneous stuff.
Now, it's interesting because on the one hand, it probably is a really good idea for students to make 3-minute films and not 90-minute films for the reasons that you, Monique, were alluding to a moment ago. At the same time, are we contributing to a kind of attention deficit disorder where nobody can focus on anything that's more than 3 minutes long?
I think that already happened. I think it's too late. But no, I think that, you know, what we're really looking at, too, is most of the students have the dream to do a longer film. And I think that what we're really looking for is quality and engagement. And from the 3-minute format, you can really start to see where your strengths are and how the story is building. And we also, as the process goes on, as they get to the capstone level, there's 5 to 7-minute films. If they get into the Emerging Filmmakers Program, which is kind of our final step, they're doing 20-minute narrative work. They're doing 40-minute documentary work. So they're starting to get into those longer formats. And the work is engaging at that point because they know that they have to keep the audience engaged. And I think that's really what we're focusing on is not to create those 90-minute films that everyone falls asleep at.
Right.
There's a place for those, for sure.
That everyone falls asleep.
Well, I mean, we all had to watch those Andy Warhol films, right?
That's, well, I wasn't forced to. I elected to.
In film school, I had to.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Those went on forever.
Aguirre, the Wrath of God.
Yeah.
Like,
oh,
you know?
Yes, I saw that movie after it came highly recommended. And yes, I fell asleep several times.
Falling asleep is the greatest blessing that can happen during that film.
Yes, absolutely.
But anyway, we're talking about the Santa Fe Community College film program. Give us some examples of what students are doing with the 3-minute format.
Well, let's see. This past semester, we had one student do what was basically a PSA commercial for adopting a dog from the animal shelter. We had another student do a music video set to an original composition. We had another student do a documentary about a Odissi dance, a form of Indian dance. We had a student do a beautiful black and white piece set up at the Chambra Chumbek Railroad up in Chama. And she shot this wonderful black and white piece about a musician following his dream. He was born to be a railroad engineer. That's what his parents had done, but he became a musician instead. And it was all done in black and white, and the whole story was told through music. So we've had one rather brilliant student who writes really wonderful story arcs do a little horror piece that was funny and didn't involve zombies,
in
thank goodness.
Minutes.
In 3 minutes. Tight story arc, a complete story, no zombies, and it came in second. It almost won Best of Show.
Wow.
Yes.
Now, what's wrong with student zombie movies?
Oh, nothing at all. No, nothing.
No, I'm just asking.
No, it's rather, I think one of the things I like best is this mix that I get of students that could be anywhere from, I have a 14-year-old student in one of my editing classes now, and I have a 79-year-old student that keeps coming back and taking classes. And I think it's wonderful that when you get that breadth of ages, I have actually had a 70-year-old student do a zombie film, and a 15-year-old do a zombie film, and the 70-year-old made the better film, which was kind of a comeuppance for the 15-year-old. So it was kind of...
What was better about it?
Well, it was witty. It was very very entertaining. There was quite a bit of eating of body parts involved. But, of course, the 70-year-old perspective was much more witty about... it was kind of like a take on... We all go back dust to dust, ashes to ashes. So it was kind of a funny thing of like how you can continue going in this marriage after they had both died. So it was really good. And the 15-year-old had, you know, your basic... created in the lab, went out and started eating people at random movie. So
right,
he saw the
So
the
one
difference.
Was more really about relationships and mortality and the other was just simply eating limbs.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting. So we're talking about the upcoming spring event, which is at Warehouse 21 this coming Sunday. It's from 10 a.m. until 10 p.m.
Yes, it's a big day. Because we have so much work submitted, we don't expect people to sit through 200 minutes of a show of 3-minute pieces. So what we do is we actually divide up the showcase. So we'll have at 10 a.m. we'll have a screening for an hour and a half. We'll have an hour and a half at 2 o'clock.
The same program?
A different program.
Okay.
So because there's so much work. And then in the evening we have like a VIP. So it's all the juried winners. It's all the honorable mentions. And it's kind of the best of show. So we'll do that at night. And then during the day, we have New Mexico filmmakers that come in. We also have Donna Wells, who is one of our emerging filmmakers from the program, is doing a documentary on the plight of the wild horse in New Mexico. And she'll be screening her film at noon and at 6 p.m. And then who do we have at 4?
Oh, Denise Lynch. She's a native New Mexican. Her family just recently repurchased the Pink Adobe, and she has beautiful films about what it is to be a New Mexican, her and her horses and her love of the land, and she'll be presenting at 4.
And then we have downstairs at Warehouse 21, because this is where this is all happening. We have the upstairs theater where these shows are going on. And then downstairs, Jason Goodyear and his Reason and Live audio classes will be doing an installation. And that's from 4 to 7, and that'll be going on. And in the morning, there's some stuff with the film club, and then we have some dolly rides outside, and some vendors are setting up tables. And I think
you're dolly rides.
Get on the dolly. Go for a ride.
Whatever it takes. It's a film industry thing.
Exactly.
It's more like a giant film festival carnival mix.
Right.
And at 5 o'clock, we have our VIP champagne reception, which we will, it's by invitation only, and it's at the J. Etkin Gallery, which is right across the parking lot from Warehouse 21, and he's hosting that for us there, and it's to raise money through NMFR for the film program.
NMFR.
New Mexico Film Resource, our brand spanking new nonprofit to raise money in support of the SFCC film program and the Emerging Filmmakers Program.
It's interesting to me that you have this combination of very young people and mature students of really all ages. And before we went on the program, you were telling me how they mentor each other. You got young people doing technical.
Oh, yeah, it's wonderful. The 15-year-old will reach over and help the 60-year-old with the keyboard commands or show them, like, what button to push on the screen to make something work, or sometimes just show them that cable's loose. And then the older student usually will look at the younger student's work and suggest a storytelling element or an aesthetic piece of advice or offer something from their own experience. It's that blend that I think makes the community college so special.
Yeah, and it's really different from teaching an undergraduate art school program where everybody's sort of 18 to 23 and don't, I mean, it's a multiple kinds of mentorship that are going on here.
Yeah, we the faculty is very much involved. We help the students out any way we can with their projects. We're usually on call at all hours to answer technical questions. Monique's cinematography and me on editing. And I think part of the reason that the blend works so well is I think when you have when young people are together, there's all that, you know, preening and, you know, trying to attract the, you know, the dating and the opposite sex thing. But when you have this nice melange group of people, there's a lot of that tension is gone. Everyone's much freer to be themselves, which
right.
I think is wonderful.
The intergenerational community, which is something we have kind of missed in a lot of our, certainly in our schooling and even in our families.
I think it's incredible to be at a screening, for instance, of a piece of student work. It could even not be something that's for a class that they just want to get feedback on. And you have peers that are, you know, in their teens, that you have peers in their 30s, peers in their 50s. You know, you have a whole range of people. And to get that kind of wealth of feedback on your work really propels you forward, I think. And you know, you were thinking about the 79. I was thinking of Rod. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Rod is an older gentleman who's been doing films on active seniors. And, you know, one of the students who's, like, in his early 20s, he's like, you know, Rod's really kind of cool. He's doing this extreme sports stuff. He's up at the ski basin. He's kayaking. And I said, he's like, this is incredible. I can't believe he's doing these extreme sports stuff. He's like, I don't think I would want to do that. But I think it sets this kind of expectation to the students thinking about, you know, and also seeing people as they grow older being active and integrated in the community and vital to the community. And it's so important to have that mix. And it's just been, I mean, I have to say the community college has been the best place I've ever taught. And it's just, it's just the diversity for me.
Yeah, I'd have to second that. I definitely think I found my calling in teaching and teaching at a community college. I don't think I would be as happy in a you know, typical school, but teaching all these different people from different places, the wealth of the diversity really makes it much more enjoyable. And it's funny because it's part of the workplace. When I graduated from college and went out into the real world, I wasn't used to working with intergenerational anything. My peers were all the same age, and then of course there were the professors. So I think it's wonderful training also, because you can go out there and you'll work on a set where people are of different ages. And even for the older students, to have a director who's a third their age, half their age, it's an incredible thing.
So We have talked on this show many times about New Mexico's burgeoning film industry, which is no longer really burgeoning, which is sort of under assault in some ways. But what are your students' career prospects when they leave the Santa Fe Community College, having done all this work and been in all this excitement and aesthetics and the teaching of film and all of that? Then they finish. What next?
Well, we have an internship program, which is really vital to our program. A lot of students will kind of filter into that internship program. And, you know, we have our great success stories where we have a young woman who came into the program, kind of took the film crew class as a whim. You know, she kind of says, oh, I'll try it out. Have an interest. And, you know, she was just stellar in that class. And it was one of those things where we had this job come in from the First Judicial Court of New Mexico, and it was through our paralegal department. And they wanted to take the forms that they had. They were turning them into Spanish language, and they taught classes to Spanish language speakers about family law. Because a lot of people who come here who don't speak English, suddenly having to navigate the court systems is just a massive undertaking.
Right.
And so this young woman, I said, you know what? I know you're bilingual, and this is the project. And she just went, that is the project for me. And you know, her family has immigrated here from Mexico. And she, that kind of the idea of helping that bilingual community was so important to her. Now, this project was not a small project. It ended up, I think they came to us saying, oh, it's going to be this small little thing. You'll have some PowerPoint and you'll do a little of this video. And it'll, you know, maybe like 40 minutes long. I think it ended up being an hour and a half. Jean worked on it.
Yes.
It was a big project.
Yes, in Spanish.
In Spanish.
So all the key people had to be bilingual. I had...
Which you are. You're
yes,
Cuban American.
Right, so I had to edit it and put Spanish language narration. We had a wonderful woman, Amparo, who came and read off all the narration that tied all the visuals
together.
And she's
together, a lawyer, which was great.
Right, in Spanish. So that was fantastic. So it was really an interesting crew because all the above-the-line people had to be bilingual.
And I have to tell the story. So here's Angelica. She's, you know, young woman, brand new to this. She's taken on this massive project, and we have this production date at the First Judicial Court. So again, you're getting through the detectors, and you're going in there with all this equipment. You've got all these people running around, and it's during a working day at the court. And I guess the judge hadn't been informed that we were going to be there. So they're like, you guys need to leave. You need to be out of here. And Helica goes up to him, starts speaking in Spanish. And he just steps back, and he's like, whoa, this is great. I love what you're doing. You guys come on into my courtroom. I'll say whatever you need me to say.
Wow.
And it was just the beginning of this beautiful relationship that she was able to get everything she needed. And then a few months later, after this kind of arduous editing process with all this Spanish language, and because the lawyers that were writing this wrote it all in English.
Right.
And they really did.
And legalese.
And legalese.
Oh, God, yes. And then marginally English.
And so, you know, we had this screening over at the college, and the judge came. All of these lawyers from this particular organization came, these community members came, and they stood up and said, Angelica, you did this amazing thing. You've done this wonderful job. They gave her a certificate for her work. And I was like in tears because this was just like one of those projects where we had no idea.
So were the lawyers. There was at least three lawyers crying. Who could have thunk it?
So it was, you know. And
I wish they'd made the whole thing in English, too. It sounds like a great.
It is.
And, yeah, and hopefully they'll ask us to do that because it would, I mean, I wouldn't have any idea.
Maybe
how to
Spanish
file for
with
divorce.
English subtitles.
There we go. For the future. So, you know, what I'm getting at, too, is that, you know, she took this under her belt. She took it on. She made it happen. Great success. And then, you know, enters into the internship program and starts interning down at Univision in Albuquerque.
Univision.
And within weeks, they're asking her, do you want to be a broadcaster? Would you like to stand in front of the camera? And then she comes to me and she goes, do I want to do that? I said, well, what do you really want to do? She's like, I want to direct. I want to produce. I said, well, get an editing job, you know? And so now she's editing for them, and it's just been fantastic. So she's got a job, full-time job. She's still in school. She's finishing up. Going to go to UNM. I'm so happy.
And it makes you so proud. How can you not want to be a teacher?
Unfortunately, it's time to wrap up now, but we're talking about the Santa Fe Community College Media Arts Spring Film Event. It's this Sunday, the 22nd of May, from 10 in the morning until 10 at night at Warehouse 21. You can go to sfcc.edu for more information. And once again, thank you so much, Monique Anair and Jean Medeiros, for being with us.
Thank you.
And we'll see you Sunday.
All right.
See you there.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.